started on our day of ground fish issues. Usual housekeeping issues with cell phones, 90-minute break, all of those items. But before we get into the first presentation, I wanted to make a couple of comments. I've been thinking about this in terms of what I would call managing expectations. We've had a lot of meetings through the Cod Working Group and the Groundfish Committee and the SSC where we have had public comment and public input. I've listened to a lot of thoughts about how the council should proceed with this issue. It would be nice if our options were quite numerous. Unfortunately, the reality is they are not. The Magnuson Act is very prescriptive about what the council can do. The executive committee, and it was in the executive committee report, is the recommendation is to pursue emergency or interim action to help solve the problem. This does not make the problem go away. At best, it will allow 1 year with some reduction in allowable catch of Gulf of Maine cod. And after that, overfishing must be curtailed. If something unanticipated happens to mitigate the problem before the 1st of May 2013, that would be great. The council has very little choice in this. And if we fail to meet our obligation, it's plain to me that secretarial action will do it for us. I'd like to turn it over now to the acting administrator of NOAA Fisheries, Sam Rock.
Thank you. I am Sam Rock, the acting assistant administrator, the head of National Fisheries Service. It is my pleasure to be able to address the council this morning in that role. I think I've addressed the council numerous times in other roles, I'm happy to be here at this difficult on this difficult day talking about this difficult issue. Ever since we first observed through that the stock assessment, what the stock assessment was telling us, we've tried to take a very aggressive approach not only to evaluating the science to make sure that we have done what we can to answer the scientific questions that are out there, and I know there are many more that are still out there, but also to look at the flexibilities that are available, new and novel ways to look at the flexibilities that are available in our statutory and regulatory mandates, and aggressively trying to engage stakeholder input. We've done this in partnership with the council, and I thank you for that. We have jointly did a work group in this very room meeting in December where we talked about our options at a very preliminary stage. I think at that point the peer review had just been done. A number of good ideas were put forward. We are following up on those ideas. Some of those things we could do and are trying to do. Others of those things are going to take longer and maybe outside the realm of our current authority. But in any event, it was a good discussion then. I think it led to it has laid the groundwork for where we are now. We've continued to work with the councils on that. On February 10th, we intend to have another follow-up meeting like that. I will describe that more a little bit later with if that's acceptable. I think that the one thing that came out of that meeting is that if the council, or if we continued on the current path given the science that we knew, the default measures, which would have been put in place, were extremely low and would have had a devastating impact on the industry. And I think the challenge now is to see if there is something that the council or the fisheries service can do to avoid that circumstance. within the bounds of the law and the science and the economic needs of the fishery. And we're trying to do that, and I look forward to the constructive discussions today. And we are prepared. I think the Fishery Service is expecting an emergency rule or interim rule request, and we hope to act on that quickly to avoid those very dire circumstances. So with that, I'll turn the agenda back over to you. And let me, before I do that, if I could, can I introduce one other person?
Please.
I wanted to introduce the head of our Fisheries General Counsel, Adam Eisenberg, who came up here with me, used to be the General Counsel for Fisheries, and now he's the same job, different title, the Section Chief of Fisheries and Protected Resources. So I think later on he'll be describing what we see as the regulatory and statutory mandates, but both he and I thought it important to come up personally to discuss these issues. These are important not just to the region, and they're vitally important to the region, but they're important nationally. And so we wanted to make sure that we gave it the proper attention. So thank you.
Thank you, Sam, and thank you for the efforts that you have put into this. Obviously, it's hugely important to this region, to the industry, and I thank you for your help and the attention you've given it. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Jim Weinberg for your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Weinberg, and I work at the Science Center. I'm the chairman of the SAWSARC process. The reports that I'll be presenting, speaking from today, are in the briefing book behind tab 3, numbers 3 and 9 behind tab 3. And mainly I'll be presenting an overview of the peer review process and how this particular peer review was run and the major findings of that peer review. And Dr. Paul Rago is also here today in the audience, and he's the chief of the Population Dynamics Branch. He's more familiar with the details of the stock assessments than I am, and therefore will be sharing the question and answer period, and I'll be primarily focusing on the process, and Paul will be answering more specific questions about the stock assessment. Okay, the SAWSARC process starts with working groups, which is number one in this slide. For the Northern Demersal Working Group, which did the cod assessment, there were three meetings which took place in September and October leading up to the peer review. And the working group meetings involved participation with the industry and with scientists from the Science Center, state biologists, and there were open meetings. These working groups have open participation. And there was also participation by industry consultants at the meeting. The external peer review, which took place, was performed by the Center of Independent Experts. And I want to stress that these reviewers are not chosen at all by the Science Center. We put in a request for reviewers, and we specify what their qualifications should be. And then through headquarters, we receive the names of the reviewers who will be coming to review the work. And as part of the process that we've worked out with the NRCC, a member of the SS committee, the SSC, chairs the meeting. And in this case, Dr. Tom Miller from the Mid-Atlantic Council was the chairman of the peer review panel. The emphasis at these meetings is primarily on reviewing the science and the assessment and not on trying to craft any sort of management or regulations. The products that come out of these stock assessments are reviewer reports. Each of the peer reviewers writes an independent report on his or her findings of the science, And then there's also a summary report that comes from the review panel that's the chairman of the review panel takes the lead on writing that, and all of the members of the review panel have to agree to that report before it's sent to us. So we have four reports from the reviewers, which we keep online on a public website. And we also have a center reference document, which is a summary report of the stock assessment itself. And that's in your briefing book. And then we also, in this case, the council wanted to get their process started because this was a very special and important case. And we provided pre-publication copies of the assessment results so that the SSC would have these documents for their deliberations. And then I've also already mentioned, number four, that these are primarily focused on the science and not on crafting technical advice. Now, specifically for this 53rd SARC, it was held in Woods Hole the week of November the 29th. The review panel and their affiliations are listed on the left. Dr. Thomas Miller was the chair, Dr. Ewan Bell, Dr. Kenneth Patterson, and Dr. Curtis Trzynski. And the latter three gentlemen were provided to us through the Center of Independent Experts. The stocks that were evaluated at this meeting were Gulf of Maine cod and black sea bass. And today I'll primarily be focusing on the results of the assessment of the Gulf of Maine cod. I'll start by showing this slide, which is from the previous assessment from GARM 3 in 2008. And on the y-axis is the ratio of the fishing mortality rate to the overfishing level. So a value of 1 on the y-axis, anything above that is overfishing. And on the x-axis is the ratio of the estimate of the stock biomass in 2007 relative to the biomass target. And in this case, the findings from GARM 3 are represented by that yellow dot with the green circle around the yellow. And they found that, first of all, overfishing was occurring because the point is above the overfishing threshold. Number two, the stock is in a rebuilding plan, and in 2007, the estimate was that it was at 58% of the biomass target. So in this case, to be rebuilt, the stock would have had to move all the way to the right side of the x-axis. And the indications in that assessment were that a large recruitment was coming in, and if realized, it was projected to rebuild the stock. And now getting on to the terms of reference for the assessment that was just done in 2011 and that I'm presenting now. The terms of reference, as most of you know, have grown quite a bit, and they 5 years ago, the terms of reference used to fit on one slide with a fairly large font. But as the SSC has become more involved in the process, every time we develop terms of reference for a stock assessment, we now send them out for comment from the councils and the ASMFC. And the terms of reference for these stock assessments have grown considerably. And so now they're about double the size of what they were 5 years ago. But basically, in a stock assessment, the first term of reference has to do with evaluating the commercial catch and the recreational catch data and characterizing its uncertainty. And in this case, they were asked to look at mortality rates that are applied to the discard components of the catch. And the second term of reference typically has to do with examining the research surveys that are done and used in these stock assessments. And in this case, they were asked to also consider whether the commercial and recreational LPUE, that's the landings per unit of effort, can be used as a measure of relative abundance of the stock. And term of reference three is fairly standard. It's calling, these are the components of a stock assessment where they're being asked to estimate the fishing mortality rate, recruitment, and biomass through time. And in addition, one thing that was added recently is to provide a historical retrospective of how previous stock assessments have shown the state of the stock relative to the current assessment. And this is different than the retrospective pattern which people talk about quite a bit at these meetings, having to do with the outcomes from one model where you look at it and analyze one less year of data. This is actually a comparison of the results from previous assessments to the current assessment. I don't think I'll be going through all of these terms of reference in such detail. I think you understand that there are a lot of them. The components are typical of a stock assessment, and as we move on to the terms of reference 7, 8, and 9, they have to do with evaluating the stock status, that is, whether it's overfished or overfishing, and also then in number 8, developing projections about the performance of the catch years down the road. And then in the final term of reference, that has to do with research recommendations, considering what work has been done, what progress has been made, and then what are the recommendations for research going forward. So reports, the working group has a number of research recommendations that they identified. In each of the peer review panel reports, there are also additional recommendations. And then I think, as you'll hear later today, when the SSC met last week, they also came up and identified a number of issues that they felt could require some additional analysis. So I think the first way to start this off is to tell you what the panel concluded. And in this case, the overall message is that the review panel accepted the stock assessment. And I can tell you that the review panel was, they really examined this from top to bottom. And I think that in general, the people at the Science Center that were involved with the review felt that the reviewers were knowledgeable and that they were critical and were very good about making constructive criticisms. So going through this list, I've gone through the panel summary report, and this is my extraction of some of the major findings, but if you were to actually go to those reports, you'll find quite a bit more. But in the interest of time, I go through the reports and I pull out what I feel are some of the major messages, major findings from the panel. So the first one was that they unanimously recommended that the results of the assessment be used for management of this stock. All of the assessment terms of reference were fully met. Both the catch and the survey data have been fully and adequately summarized. The assessment model, and this is a new model called the ASAP, was appropriately applied, and the model outputs represent the best scientific estimates available. The 2005 cod year class in the Gulf of Maine was less strong than suggested by analyses conducted in 2008. And I'll be talking a little more about this later. Regarding the biological reference points, the working group had suggested that they might switch to a different overfishing level. And the panel considered this, and they didn't feel that that was justified, and they suggested sticking with the F40% as the overfishing, as the basis for the overfishing reference point. And Gulf of Maine cod stock is overfished and experiencing overfishing. The panel findings, this is the second slide of findings. The projections indicate that the stock will not be rebuilt by 2014. Now, this next one is kind of a bridge between the previous assessment and this one. The perception of stock biomass has changed markedly. There's lower biomass estimated now. And this is the result of changes in the weights at age, resulting from the inclusion of complete discard data in the estimates of weights at age, and reductions in the estimated 2005 year class strength, resulting from observations of this year class recruiting to surveys and the fishery. And these changes are well documented and appropriate. The retrospective pattern in the model fit is a source of uncertainty in stock size and projection estimates. And there was some discussion at the meeting about looking geographically at whether the stock was throughout the Gulf of Maine or was more concentrated in the southwestern part of the Gulf of Maine. And the panel found that the stock appears more aggregated in the western part of the Gulf of Maine in recent years. And they added, in this situation, commercial catches per unit of effort can be maintained even with declining overall stock size. So those are the highlights of the panel findings. And now I'd like to show some of the results from the stock assessment and then get to the stock status determination. So this figure shows the catch of Gulf of Maine cod from 1982 to 2010. The catches were higher in the 1980s than they are today. For the commercial landings, which are the light gray region in the that goes along the top of the graph, 95% of those landings are from trawl and gillnet. And a minor part of those landings are from hand line jigs. And then the lower part of the graph, the black and the gray bar just above that represent the recreational landings and discards. And a greater fraction of the catch is recreational. And of the recreational catch, about 60% is landed and about 40% is currently discarded. Now, one of the findings that I already mentioned is that the stock appears to have become more concentrated, and that's indicated in these graphs. This is a statistical index called the Gini index, and it was developed by an Italian economist who was looking at how wealth is distributed among the people in a community. So if all the wealth is in the hands of just a few people, the index goes up. And if it's distributed throughout the population more evenly, it goes down. So that's what this index shows. And it's been applied to the Gulf of Maine cod from our survey data. And y-axis is time, and the y-axis is this Gini index, and the x-axis is time. And there are four plots here, one for the fall surveys and one row for the spring surveys, and then you have the Gini index plotted, you know, in each of the plots for spring and fall for abundance and biomass. And in each case, the index is increasing over time from 1970 onward to 2010. And since then, there have been some analyses done at the center looking at the commercial catches as well, and they have similar trends. And this next figure shows some of the data. These are binned into larger blocks. The survey indices that you saw in the previous figure were year by year, but these are in blocks of about 10 years. And these show the it's difficult to see. It's much better if you have a color image on a computer screen right in front of you. But the these are the kind of data that were used for calculating the index that was shown in the previous slide. And the most recent data are in this particular figure from 2001 to 2010. I think you can see that most of the dark dots are in the western side of the region. And if you compare that to some of the earlier figures, there's more spreading of the survey catches throughout the region. This slide is a comparison of the current results with some of the previous stock assessments that were done. So for if we start with the very bottom lines, which are, I think in color, they're purple, they're blue and red. But the lines that are at the very bottom here are the results from the most recent stock assessment. And I think from looking at this, you can see that if you compare these results to, say, the line above it, which is in gray, that ends in 2007, that the previous stock assessments had a history of overestimating the stock size relative to the current assessment. And in particular, that 2007 estimate from the GARM 3, which is this point up here, that was the estimate of the biomass in 2007 from GARM 3. And if you compare that to the current estimate, which is much lower, and that's at least partially the result of, I mentioned that the weights at age of the fish that were caught were redone, used this time incorporating the discarded fish, and that accounts for a large part of that reduction. And then another point that I wanted to make for the most recent assessment, there are two lines here, and they represent the VPA model results, which that's the model that was used in the previous stock assessment. And the other line is the new ASAP model. So switching to a different model isn't responsible for the change in the perception of the stock. They preferred the ASAP model because it was more flexible, and it allowed for it had in terms of how you can analyze its how well it fits and its statistical properties and the ability to do sensitivity analyses. It's a preferred approach. So that was why the ASAP model was adopted. But I want to emphasize that switching from the VPA to the ASAP did not cause a change in the perception of the stock. Now, getting to the output from the model, here are the results of the model related to fishing mortality rate. And across the x-axis is time from 1982 to 2010. The y-axis is the fishing mortality rate that is estimated by the model. And the overfishing threshold is indicated here by this hatched line going across at point 2. Point 2 represents the value of fishing mortality rate above which overfishing is occurring. And based on the output from the model, all of the points are above the line. And the most recent point is about 1.14, which is about five times greater than the overfishing threshold. Similarly, here are the results with respect to the spawning stock biomass. And again, the axes are similar. There's a time on the x-axis, biomass on the y-axis. The overfished threshold is shown by the dashed line. And so that's the overfished threshold. The target would be double that at about 60,000 metric tons. So the overfished threshold is at about 30,000 metric tons. And from the output of the model, the spawning stock biomass, which is this line here, for the entire time series is below the overfished threshold. It's currently at about 10,000 metric tons. So that would put it in the overfished condition. And it's been below the overfished threshold for the entire time series. Here are some results that show recruitment over time. These vertical bars are the estimates of the recruits coming in each year. And the point that I wanted to make here is that the recruitment in the past, like if you find the five largest recruitments, they're from earlier years. And the recruitment in the last 10 years or so has been below average in general. Well, that didn't turn out too well, but this is a projection from... enough is showing here that I can make the point. When these working groups do their work, they're asked to make some projections about what the stock will do. And this is... That's okay. This is one of the projections that was done. Since this time, the PDT, working with the center, has done additional projections. And we'll be hearing, and I think when Tom Neese speaks later today, we'll be seeing additional projections that have been done. But this is one of the projections that was produced during the peer review. And this one shows a projection of how the stock would perform if the fishing mortality rate were reduced to zero. And so it's starting at a very low value at around 10,000 metric tons. And then even at an F of zero, the stock would not reach the 60,000 tons, which is the rebuilding level, the biomass target, until about 2018. And so this is just an example of a projection that was done. And this is the basis for saying that the stock would not rebuild by 2014. So putting all this on one figure, these are the results from the latest assessment. Again, the yellow dot represents the output of the model. The fishing mortality rate is at about 1.14. So it's, again, the conclusion is that overfishing is occurring. The stock is overfished because it's at 19% of the way to the biomass target. And it's below this line, which, when it falls below 50%, it's declared overfished. And the chance of rebuilding by 2014 is less than 1%, even with F equals zero. And here are some of the recommendations that the SARC panel made. Even though they endorsed and accepted the assessment, there are always additional things that can be looked at. And here are some of the things that they mentioned. The increase the inspection and analysis of survey data prior to inclusion of these data in the model. And this has to do with the fact that in the previous stock assessment, there were indications that there was a strong recruitment pulse coming in. And the panel felt that if the center had placed more emphasis on how many toes in that survey really indicated that there was a strong recruitment event coming in, that it would have been useful to put that kind of detail into the report. And in this case, when they took a closer look, they found that the conclusion that a big recruitment pulse was coming in was largely driven by just one or two toes out of a large number of toes. And by hitting the school while they were doing random surveys, that really jacked up the estimate of the biomass in a particular stratum, which had a big influence on the result. And it's always under debate when you do random surveys and you catch a boomer toe or two, what to do with that. It's not unusual when one is doing fish surveys to encounter this sort of thing. But the panel did recommend really placing greater emphasis on describing that kind of result in the report. And that can also affect the description of the projection, how reliable that projection is likely to be. Number two, implement methods that do not rely on the survey vessel conversion factors as soon as the length of the Bigelow time series permits. The panel felt that the way the Bigelow data were treated, that was fine, but they preferred, as soon as there's a longer time series, switch over to using the Bigelow data as a separate time series. The model diagnostics reviewed at the meeting were adequate, and the panel recommended that these diagnostics be included routinely in assessments. I must say that the reviewers really put the assessment scientists to work each night doing additional sensitivity runs. They wanted to try to turn over as many rocks as they could during the week to really examine the sensitivity of the model to various things. And they couldn't look at everything during the meeting, but they did at least five different sensitivity runs. And these are the sorts of things that they wanted to see in every stock assessment. Assess the potential causes and consequences of the observed aggregation. There's no compelling reason to abandon F40 as the overfishing proxy. Stock projections should be recalculated to reduce recruitments at low stock sizes. And this is something that the scientists were able to implement during the meeting, and that's how the projections are being run. And basically what that means is in the projection, when the stock gets very low, the assumption about what sort of recruitment will be coming in is lower than for cases when the biomass is high. So it's not treating recruitment as a constant throughout the entire biomass stream. And the panel recommends that efforts be undertaken to reassess the stock definition for Gulf of Maine cod. And this is something that will probably come up in the question and answer period, but stock definition was not a term of reference for this meeting, although people recognized that there was quite a bit of interest in reassessing the stocks. But in general, this was not something that could be done one stock at a time. If the term of reference becomes to reassess the stock definition, then it has to be done and include the Georges Bank and Gulf of Maine at the same time. It would also affect Canada and also has a lot of implications for fishery management plans and so forth. So anyway, we recognize this as an important topic, but I specifically want to point out that at this meeting, the reviewers were not asked to work on this. And I have some results here for black sea bass, but I don't think there's interest in my going through that in the same detail. So I'm just going to skip that, and that will end my presentation. And Paul and I will be happy to try to answer your questions. Thank you.
I was looking forward to the black sea bass.
Thank you, Jim. We've got Terry and then Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your indulgence, I have a number of questions about the SOSAR conclusions, which I anticipate will help frame our discussions for the rest of the day. That's seven or eight topics. But the first is about the MRFs and the MREP. I'm going to address these all to you, Paul, since Jim has so kindly deferred the questions to you. Later this morning, we expect to receive new estimates of the recreational catch that appear to reduce the catches of Gulf of Maine cod. How will this affect the assessment results?
Okay. Thank you, Terry. In general, the results of the MRFIS, the data, are important in terms of the terminal year catches. We have data from 2004 through 2010, which do affect the assessment. The estimates for 2010 are roughly 50% lower than those that were used in the assessment. For the period prior to that, so 2004 to 2009, the estimates are on the order of about 20% less than had previously been estimated. A major consequence is that for estimates earlier than 2004, so 1982 to 2003, we do not have estimates of MRIP. So in order to incorporate that information into the model more fully, that is explicitly and incorporate not only the size structure but also the relationship between the MRFIS data and the MRIP data, it's necessary to do a fairly detailed calibration, so to speak, of, you know, what the relationship would be. Sorry for the length of this. I just wanted to give you the context of how this impact can be evaluated. We have done a sensitivity analysis which examines the influence of the MRIP data with the caveats that I just described. That is, using the average relationship for 2004 through 2009 as a measure of the offset, if you will, for the historical recreational data. When that sensitivity analysis is applied to the resource, the result is that the terminal year fishing mortalities are reduced. The estimates of stock size are relatively unaffected, but that has to do with a lot of the complexities of how the model deals with the changes in weights and age and so forth. But overall, the effect is that it reduces the terminal year fishing mortality. That being said, the gravity of this, the importance of this information is such that it affects a lot of different stocks. It has implications not only in the Northeast but also throughout the rest of the country. And in order to deal with that, there is a national workshop that is going to be convened to try to more fully characterize how that information should be both extrapolated backwards and incorporate into the stock assessments. So what we have now are measures that are indicative but not definitive in terms of their influence on stock composition, on fishing mortality and the estimates of stock size.
A follow-up to that is, You mentioned about the workshop. So when are we going to know for sure, and how is it going to be incorporated into the assessment?
The workshop is scheduled, I believe, for the end of March. And the results of that meeting should be helpful in terms of defining a methodology that can be applied across the board. Whether that methodology is one that is the result of a complete redefinition of the fishing, if that methodology is a redefinition of the historical catch data in terms of the sampling methodologies and the improvements in sampling methodology that have been devised as part of the MRFIS to MRIP conversion. So the open-ended question is, when will the center engage in a new stock assessment for this? I can't answer that. I think that will be, I know there are some motions on the floor directly oriented towards that, but I think we can we can gain some insight into the potential influence of these changes. But there are a lot of things that change when you update the data that establish the underlying scale of population size and models, and just to emphasize, within stock assessments, the major determinant of scale, that is the size of the population, are the estimates of the total removals. So this is a critically important aspect of this stock assessment. And I thank Tom. He has put up the information, the direct information on the change in the spawning stock biomass and average F associated with that. These are slides that, or this presentation is one that was developed for the Statistical and Scientific Committee at its January 25th meeting, which my colleague Chris Legall will be describing later. But on the left is the difference between the stock size estimates with for the with and without the MRFIS data, and then on the right is the estimates of fishing mortality. And I think the most important difference there, of course, is that on the right hand side. I'll probably turn this thing off at some point. On the right-hand side, you can see that disparity in the terminal year, and that is the difference in the fishing mortality rate. It goes from about 1.14 on the fully recruited fish to about 0.7 or 8 or something on that order. So thanks, Terry.
Can I continue, Mr. Chair?
A couple more.
Discard mortality. Chris is also going to talk about that, but the assessment assumes all the discards are dead. It's been pretty widely criticized. And so given all the evidence from the research projects, tagging studies, et cetera, how did the SOSARC justify this assumption?
Thank you. There were a great deal of discussion about this. In fact, the working group spent a full day discussing the various discard mortality estimates. It's very clear that it's not 100%, it's not 0%, it's somewhere in between. When a stock assessment is done, there are a lot of operational decisions that are made about the magnitude of various factors and how to treat the different types of data. In this context, after much discussion, involvement with a lot of different parties and scientists, I believe there were some industry in the people in the room, but the general consensus was that the studies that had been done are very good, but they don't necessarily extend broadly to many other temperatures, regions, depths, and things of that sort. They also oftentimes, have some limitations in terms of experimental protocol, in such that animals that might otherwise die due to predation or something are protected from that because they're caged. There are a number of concerns that were raised, which led the group to use 100% discard mortality as an operational bound for the assessment. And clearly, there are under certain conditions, under conditions where you're selecting fish for tagging, it's well known that those fish do survive, and are, since they are returned. So I mean, that's not the case. But it was trying to characterize what is more of a typical situation for the fishing process. The size of toes, length of overnight gill net sets, and things of that sort. Thank you.
I saw a lot of hands going up. Could I ask one more before? This is concerning CPUE. Both the wreck and the commercial fishermen are reporting increased CPUEs. How did the assessment use CPUE as an input or examine the data in detail?
We did a pretty thorough examination of the potential to use contemporary CPUE in the stock assessment. Now, there is a survey, a CPUE index, which is based on an earlier time period, 1982 through 1992 or 93, in which we have estimates of catch per unit effort derived from interviews of fishermen. So the old inter-port interview process was used as the basis for defining a measure of effort. The primary difficulty in terms of using a catch per unit effort is related to the definition of effort. The efficiency of vessels has changed greatly over time, not only due to technological changes, but also the knowledge and skill of the captains in the fleet. Government regulations or management regulations have been very effective in terms of reducing the efficiency of the fleet in various ways, not only through changes in the clock, changes in the distance which fishermen can effectively move from shore, through trip limits, through closures, permanent and seasonal, and all of these measures make it extremely difficult. And then the other measure on top of that would be the sectors. So collectively, it makes it extraordinarily difficult to define an unequivocal measure of the fishing effort in the fleet. I realized that the perception on this is that the scientists are being dismissive of the information that is provided on the vessel trip reports or through other means. And I want to, if nothing else today, I want to convey the fact that that is not the case. That we fully appreciate the core of the assessments, which is derived from the reports provided by the commercial fishing industry, by the data provided through dealers, and the observer program and the information we gleaned from that. It's simply one of tractability, and although there are some methods which allow for use of commercial CPUE data, they are oftentimes not considered in sort of the dynamic complex or the suite of changes that have occurred in commercial fishing since 1994. So we have attempted to use those data. There are broad patterns which are suggestive of general consistency with certain parts of the assessment, but it's very difficult to sort of get an unequivocal measure, which is not simply a measure of more measures that are restricted in either space or time in terms of their ability to draw inference about the larger population. So I apologize for the length of that question, but I do want to get that major point across. There's in no sense is there a sense of within any of the scientists that are involved in this process that we're dismissive of the information that we would like to incorporate it, and we're looking at ways to try to do that. But in this sort of context, it's very, very difficult. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few other questions later, if time permits.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Paul. It's good to see you here, and I appreciate all the information that you're providing for us. I have three questions. One, the first one relates to a follow-up on the question regarding the discard mortality. Clearly, as you stated, it's not zero, it's not 100%. And I wanted to know, did the assessment panel do any sensitivity runs to see if changes in the discard mortality estimate, in the value of the discard mortality estimate, would change the terminal year fishing mortality rate or the SSB levels? And if they are, do you have an idea of how much they were changed by?
Thank you, Doug. There was an investigation of the change in discard mortality. There were three scenarios that were examined. They ranged from the 100% as the base case, 50% mortality, and 0% mortality. Now, the important thing to remember about changing the magnitude of the discard mortality means that there are fewer fish in the population that are being removed. You know, if you assume that those that are caught subsequently live, that means that the mortality, the accounting on that side of the ledger, is smaller. So when you use a stock assessment model to try to reconstruct the population sizes, that is the total scale, it means because fewer fish were removed, you need fewer fish to support that level of removal overall. So the typical consequence of changing the fishing mortality, or that is the discard mortality rate, is that the average number of recruits declines in that context. That being said, change in discard mortality has profound implications for individual fishermen, for their catch shares and the counting and things of that nature. The consequence of going to 0% mortality was to drop the terminal year fishing mortality rate, I believe, to 0.73, somewhere in that range. From the rate which it currently is on of 1.14, so it's about a 30% decline in the estimate of the terminal year value. A large part of that is driven by the reduction that occurs in response to the change in the magnitude of the B2s, the discards in the recreational catch, which when reduced, I think they're on the order of 2,500 metric tons is the MRFIS estimate of that. The MRIP estimate for the comparable data set is on the order of half of that. So there's potentially a double effect of the reduction in discard mortality and the reduction in discard total estimated through that process.
Was there a sensitive run done on 50%, or was it just zero and 100%?
It was done on 50%, I believe. Tom may have as everybody can see on the right hand on the table up above there, it's 0.97. So there are there were three values examined, and at the 100% mortality, which is the top row, it's 1.14, 0.97 when you reduce it by half, and 0.73 when you say that it's zero.
Okay, thank you. The next two questions are sort of getting at the concern that the difficult position that we're all in because of the positive outlook that was shown 3 years ago, and clearly there were some changes made this year to this year's assessments, and to try and at least from what I understand, improve the assessment, make it more accurate. The first question I have is, was there a it makes total sense to me that you would include discards in the weighted age calculations. And so my question is, why in the 2008 assessment wasn't that done? It seems like a very intuitive thing that we should have included in the assessment. And considering it made such a big difference in the overall outlet, do you have any thing that you can enlightenment you can provide on that?
It was not a it should have been included. We didn't include it at the time. The estimates of average weight were based solely on the average weight in the landings, which, as we know, in any given age class is going to result in a biased estimate of higher stock weights. The consequence of not including that meant that the estimates of the stock weights, that is the population size, were too high. And the major consequence in this assessment, the reason for the rescaling of the population, is related to the change in the average weights associated with the catch. That consequence is, the other one is the 2005 year class, but I'm sure that's a separate question for somebody. But that is a huge difference in the should have been included. I think that much has been made about the uncertainty in the assessment and much of the discussion, but I think it's important to recognize that this assessment is an order of magnitude deeper in terms of its examination of the underlying data, of its thoroughness in terms of testing alternative hypotheses, in terms of the model that has been prepared to try to evaluate all of these alternatives. I fully recognize that existing uncertainties remain, but I would argue that we now have a method an approach which allows for full consideration of those uncertainties in the modeling context. So, thank you, Don.
And my final question does relate to the 2005 year class, but I think you partially may have addressed it, or the review panel. They've asked that or recommended that you increase the inspection and analysis of the survey data prior to inclusion of these data in the model. And as you had indicated, that the 2005 year class in the previous assessment had largely been driven by one or two toes, and I assume based on this recommendation that from now on the Science Center will be looking very closely at how to utilize the survey data a little bit more closely, so that we can get a more refined picture of what the status of the stock is on these strong year classes.
I completely affirm your conclusion. We will be looking at each data point much more closely. In fact, that was done in this assessment, and it was clear that the coefficient of variation, the relative precision of the 2006 and 2007 estimates of abundance were in fact driven very strongly by singular toes that dwarfed the magnitude of the penultimate toes in the overall survey. The consequence of that is that since it is the terminal year of the model in terms of what the model is sensitive to, it tends to be driven more by the magnitude of the survey index. In that case, the estimate of the stock size or the recruitment was on the order of 23 million fish when fully accounted for, and in retrospect, after you've had a few years of observation about not only in the survey but also in the catch data, it suggested it was about one-third of that value. With respect to my earlier statement about the modeling context, the new modeling paradigm does explicitly incorporate the uncertainty of the estimates in the estimation. It is no longer driven as a measure of that would unilaterally go to the terminal year point, which would then tend to create the whipsaw effect that oftentimes occurs in these types of the earlier BPA type model.
David Pierce.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Could you put the slide back up that shows the recreational catch and the mortality assumptions for the different for discards? Because I'm still confused about something, and I need to get it clarified before I move on. Okay, I know the audience can't see the little table that's above the figures, but the top bar where it says the base, no. It says the fishing mortality is 1.14. That's the base. And now you assume 50% mortality, not 100% mortality. It drops to 0.97. And then if you assume 0% mortality, it drops a little bit more to 0.73. What I'm confused about is these particular discard assumptions, are they applied to the recreational catch that was used in the assessment, or are these applied to the adjusted recreational catch that you just referenced, that indeed recreational catch was not what we thought it was, it was far less?
This assumption, this scenario, this sensitivity analysis was done only on the data within the current assessment, which was the MRFIS data. So the recreational catches, which were overestimated based on the MRIP, the revised MRIP data, were not included in this. So this looks at the effect of a singular change in the base model and not the composite change, which would be reflected in both a discard and a discard mortality assumption and a recreational catch assumption.
Okay. So that means then that if we go with what you said initially, that with the corrected recreational catch, fishing mortality drops from around 1.1 to about 0.8. Okay, so now the base should be 0.8. Applying different assumption to discard mortality to recreational catch then would get us a fishing mortality rate, let's say with 50% mortality, well below the 0.97 that's up there, and certainly I would think well below the 0.80 that you just said we would get with the adjusted recreational catch, 100% discards. And it would drop even lower if we assumed, unrealistically, 0% mortality. I tend to go with the 50% mortality as a good figure to use. So I'm still searching for where we are with the adjusted recreational catch and, let's say, with the 50% mortality estimate. It appears to me that we may be looking at a number that is below 0.7. But I look to you for some guidance on that, because this is such a critical issue. I'm not talking about biomass. That's another matter. I'm talking about fishing mortality, because the first thing that captured my attention when the new assessment came out was that 1.1. So where are we, Paul?
Well, we have not done, a complete analysis of those options. They were mentioned as part of the SSC review that was done January 25th, and in that context, there was some discussion about the joint effect. One of the issues of taking such a sensitivity analysis and running with it right away is that it has all of the limitations associated with what I mentioned earlier about the MRIP to MRFIS conversion, and particularly what do you assume about the historical data, the 2003 and earlier data. I think the directionality that you've inferred is correct, that it is in that ballpark. If I remember the terminal year estimates, it's on the order of about 0.8 or so. But again, that was an exploratory exercise. It's not in the same degree of rigor that's associated with this. The other point to mention, sorry for the short answer, short questions, long answer kind of thing, but the other thing is that the consequence of these changes can be examined in a situation like this, but they also have big implications for the reference points. So, when you change the average weight at age because you're excluding smaller size fish that are being discarded, you have implications for the estimates of total recruitment. You also have estimates that change the selectivity pattern, and you also have consequences for the referenced biomass target that are associated with that. But
yeah, I'm going to go with the assumption, therefore, based upon my logic and your responses, that when all is said and done, we're likely at 0.6 for fishing mortality rate and not at 1.1. And if it's around 0.6 thereabouts, it puts us pretty much in the range of fishing mortality rates that we've had since about the year 1999. Not that it's a good fishing mortality rate, because it's still high, relatively speaking, but it's not the kind of fishing mortality that you would think would push us over the edge. Now, you just mentioned an important point about the weight at age, and again, a clarification. That weight at age that played the revisions in the assessment that played such an important part in the new numbers, clarification, was that a change in the weight at age of fish caught in the survey, the bottom trawl survey, or was that a change in the weight at age that was demonstrated through commercial catch?
That was a change related to the weighted age in both the commercial and the recreational catch. It's related to the length frequency distribution of the sampled fish that are taken in commercial sampling. It incorporates the length frequency information taken by observers on the size frequency of discarded fish. It also takes into account the intercept estimates of length frequencies taken in the MRFIS survey. So all of those estimates constitute the basis for a change in the average weight.
Okay.
The survey estimates are not used as part of the estimates of the stock weights.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Did the average weight per age of the fish go up, or did it go down, based upon the assessment versus what was used previously?
It went down for most of the ages. The reason for that is that for ages one through three predominantly, those are the fish that are discarded. So the you're having fewer small fish. You're including small fish in with the fish that are landed. So the mixture of those two results in a smaller average weight than you would get if you were simply looking at the average weight in the landings. Now, for larger fish, 4 years old and up, the differences in average weight were much smaller because there's much fewer fish of those sizes discarded. And the only times they were typically discarded were during periods of the trip limits.
Okay, so then this finding is consistent with what the council has received from the center in previous meetings, that across the entire Northeast, it seems, for just about every stock, such as the Georges Bank haddock stock, the average size, the average weight per age has been dropping, indicating less productivity of the whole ecosystem. So it's consistent with those findings, right?
Well, it is consistent with those findings, but it has a different basis. There was no direct evidence of major change in the average weights on cod, although there is some decline in the average weights. It's not of the magnitude that occurred in this assessment through this evaluation. The previous estimates were overestimates of the average weight of fish. The reduction in average weight at age in both the stock and the catch is a result of the inclusion of the a better characterization of that which is being removed in the fishery. So I think it's important not to conflate those two causal mechanisms. One is a true change in productivity. There is evidence of that for several stocks. There is slight evidence for that in cod. It's not dramatic. What is major, what is the factor that causes this change in apparent productivity, a change in the average weights at age, and a change in the estimates of stock size, is that change in average weight at age.
Okay, from just one final question. Yeah. The year classes that are coming in obviously are important for this council. We need to know the strengths of the incoming year classes. If the strengths of the year classes that are out there now and will eventually recruit to the fishery, if they're poor, then we really do have a major league problem and we need to be responsive to that. So what was the SAR conclusion regarding the strengths of the most recent year classes, 2009, 2010, and even 2011? Because we need to have a good feel for that as we decide what to do here today.
I believe Jim had in his slide, he has the estimates of the recruitments. The recruitment incoming is generally low. But it's not dramatically low. We don't look at, cod does not vary in year class strength like haddock does. We're talking about one order of magnitude changes, not two orders of magnitude changes over time. The 2011 stock size estimates, recruitments, are not included in the model. Although the information in terms of the incoming strength of that from I believe the Massachusetts spring survey was down. There was also low numbers in our survey as well. So there is some indication in the graph depicted on the screen there. You can see that it's among the lowest on record. There was no commentary explicit by the reviewers on that magnitude. Its influence comes in when we do begin to do the forecasting of stock size, because those recruits are sort of the primary stock structure that is at the end of the assessment period is the primary determinant of the short-term catch limits that are possible within the model or within management. So they certainly have bearing for the out year projections. Tom will get into the details of that in terms of the expected stock characteristics under different levels of removals. But there's no good news in there. None of those big peaks on the left have shown up on the right in recent years. So that would not be an optimistic outlook. So thank you.
Frank Bone.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unlike Dave, I am going to ask a couple of questions on basically the biomass. And I'm looking at slide 13, that's similar to that Jim had up. But what I'm seeing, if I'm reading it correctly, if you go on the SART 53, because we're hearing a lot of, you know, people saying they're seeing a lot of codfish and they've disappeared and that. But if I'm correct on this, of the last 19 years, there's only been 2 years or 3 years with a higher biomass than we currently have, and it's been lower than that for the entire time series. Is that correct?
That would be the I agree with that, yes.
Okay, and I understand that the terminal year now it is going downward, so that would go along with what most people in the audience are going to say, that they're seeing codfish in this. So it's we're hearing that it's a collapse and there's no fish, but the problem is that they've disappeared from the assessment. But my other question is, and I have a very big concern, when you say that if we use 100%, if we don't use the 100% discard mortality, we have to be careful because it will make the biomass smaller. I understand that, and I know how you calculated it. But if that's the case and the biomass is actually smaller than we think, I think that's what we should be going with. If not, we're just picking a number that makes the biomass look bigger. So it almost looks like you're picking and choosing, not you individually, but I mean that you're using, by using 100%, it makes the picture rosier than it is. And if that's not the case, we need to know the actual number and not just saying that by using this, the biomass looks bigger and things aren't as bad. So I have some concerns there, if I understood you correctly.
I think you did understand the implications of the change in discard mortality and its consequences for the stock size. Whether we could use some sort of process to get a better estimate of the discard mortality or more broad-based agreement on what that value is, I think is a process for the council to discuss as to, you know, what that might be. You know, oftentimes discard mortality estimates end up being a consensus value resulting from, you know, the available studies that have been conducted to date and the degree of uncertainty associated with them. But, you know, it's something it is a magnet for interest in this assessment, and it's one that, as we said, it's at the extreme end of the feasible range. Thank you, Sherlock. Right, but that's it is the difference.
Okay. Thank you. And I've got probably two or three more questions, but they're probably better. I'll wait till probably after Gordon gives his presentation, and I think that might be better addressed then.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I've got three, maybe four questions. I'll try to talk fast. Paul, if I look at the graph, and you mentioned the 2005 year class was overestimated, and I see the magnitude of the spawning stock biomass estimation, but doesn't it go back further that GARM 1, GARM 2, and GARM 3 overestimated the spawning stock biomass if we're looking at this new assessment?
Yes, that's true.
And then a follow-up question, another question is, why was it determined to use a time series of 1982 forward and not use a longer time series, as was suggested by Dr. Butterworth's paper, back to 1962 or 3, something like that, which was done in Hake and seemed to work pretty well.
One of the primary reasons was the absence of age data for the period, the commercial age data in the earlier period there. So it was the examination of the catch data suggested an extreme reliance on only the total removals and no information about the underlying stock structure. There were multiple investigations of that, as part of the working group process. We appreciate the contributions that Dr. Butterworth made to that process, and it certainly sharpened everyone's analytical skills as a result of that. But the bottom line was that there was not sufficient justification to do it. Models that had included those earlier estimates were often characterized by poor goodness of fit. That is, there were unreasonable estimates of not only the population size, but also the fishing mortality rates. So,
a couple more. One is natural mortality. Are we still continuing to use 0.2 in this assessment?
Yes, we are.
I'm familiar with what we've been dealing with in the track in the Eastern Canada, and I note that the Canadians are using 0.5 and 0.7 for some of their cod stocks, and we actually ran two numbers at the track of 0.2 and 0.5, and I'm wondering if you guys considered running a number here of 0.5 to see what the outcome would be.
We did not consider a value of 0.5. There was some There was a good deal of discussion about natural mortality and the assumed value of 0.2. It is consistent with life history traits and all the other types of justifications that are typically used. It is not consistent with changes in densities of some of the predators and whether it varies by age class. That being said, we did try to elicit or incorporate predation, like from seals, which of course is considered to be a major component of natural mortality in many of the Canadian stocks, and there was a recent paper, of course, demonstrating that showing that through various exercises that the mortality related to seal predation was high. The direct evidence of that for the Gulf of Maine stock was absent. So we didn't feel it was a valuable or possible to do that. The other thing I think that's relevant in terms of the Eastern Georges Bank stock assessment is that it has a very large retrospective pattern, and there have been various approaches that have been used to try to explain that, one of which is the estimate of 0.5, but it's there are a variety of approaches to do that, but I guess the bottom line was that there was no direct evidence to suggest a major departure in the natural mortality rate for the Gulf of Maine.
Just one more question, and I'm not sure I'm reading this right, but it looks to me like for this assessment, you used a discard rate for the commercial fleet of 10% of catch. And if that's so, I think it was much, much, much higher by magnitudes when we were under days at sea.
And I'm wondering if you guys looked at that and how that would have affected the assessment.
We didn't use a flat rate. Each year was based on the observer data from 1989 onward. There were earlier years in which we did have to make some assumption about that. So that would, in the context of this model, it's 1982 to 1988. For the period of the assessment in which we do have fairly intensive observer program coverage. The rate varied considerably in the days of the. I computed the percents while I was sitting in the back there, so because I figured that would be highly relevant. But I may have a moment here. Okay. You are. Of course, exactly right. During the period of the trip limits, the discard estimates were exceeded the landings in 1999. They were, but then, which was of course the trip limit, and then dropped on the order of about 50% for the following 3 years. Since then, the percentage decline has been, the percent of discards in commercial has averaged on the order of about 10%, but has declined. The most recent estimate was, 5% is the overall estimate. It's also important that, there are differences, of course, in gear. And the Gulf of Maine fishery has transitioned to a much greater fraction of gill nets over time than in the past.
I have Dave Gaethel. Then we are. I will entertain some questions from the audience, but Dave first.
Okay. Morning, Paul. I'm. Not sure where to begin here. As you know, I got serious issues. The questions have been asked. I'm going to start with just one statement on the discard issue. If we had 100% mortality, there shouldn't have been a fish left in the Gulf of Maine by 2000. I mean, the amount of codfish that were thrown back in 1998, 99, and 2000 were, literally millions and millions of pounds. If some of those fish didn't live, there wouldn't have been anything left. We just kept catching them over and over and over. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read things from that other people have written, because that way hopefully my questioning will seem a little more neutral. The first quote I got to read you is, the panel identified substantial concerns over the potential for spatial structure and incomplete mixing within the stock area that compromised the ability of the forward projecting catch at age model to index abundance and fishing mortality. I assume you recognize that quote. That's from the black sea bass rejection. And then I'm going to read you the quote from the letter that was sent to me. First paragraph, it says, reconsidering cod stock boundaries requires a comprehensive evaluation for all stock components and available information, including any new tagging data, rather than one component in isolation. I agree with that. This kind of review is beyond the normal SAWSARC benchmark assessment process and was not a term of reference for SAWC 53 Gulf of Maine cod assessment. It may not have been a term of reference, but the last I knew, when we did a benchmark assessment, we evaluated everything from soup to nuts. And if we don't evaluate everything from soup to nuts, then we haven't done our job. Reconsideration of boundaries also affects management measures that are based on them. That's not a concern of science, such as annual allocations of cod to the fishery. That sounds like the politicization of science to me. And fishery data collection and monitoring requirements, I agree with that. This kind of thorough biological and management review is best conducted in collaboration with the Canadians. I agree with that. We should have invited them to the stock assessment. And all stakeholders well in advance. That's where I disagree. This should have been done while the stock assessment was being conducted. So my question is, in light of the fact that they rejected the black sea bass stock assessment for basically this very reason, stock boundary issues, why should we accept this one?
Well, I mean, I think there are some there were other issues associated with the black sea bass stock assessment that were relevant to the sort of the conclusion that it was not sufficient for management purposes. But the stock structure issue is certainly one that I don't and none of my colleagues dismiss as important. I do think that in terms of conducting a stock assessment, it's important to recognize the limitations of the underlying data that are obtained. That is, the degree of resolution spatially that we have is stat area. The degree of resolution we have in the surveys are stratum boundaries. The ability to partition that information such that we can reconfigure the stock structure is very challenging. The other context on that is that it's in order to reconstruct the information on removals, it becomes an enormous task that and I'm no one to shirk work, but you know it is one that takes a lot of time. So unless there's agreement on what the underlying nature of the stock structure is, then it becomes the consequence is that if you revise the stock structure, you need to be able to do the assessment consistent with that stock structure. The stock structure has implications not only for this stock but also for the redefinition of whether it's Gulf of Georges Bank, Gulf of Maine, or the Forex Canadian resource. I realize I'm not satisfying you with this answer, but it is the reality of the ability to redefine it, and it is one that cannot take place in the context of a normal stock assessment meeting. So.
Okay. Well, I will be making a motion this afternoon to have COD assessed. Not Gulf of Maine COD, not Georges Bank COD, COD. That's how this should be done. And all these things should be examined at this time. None of these stock assessments will be right until we get the spatial structure right. This idea that the stock is contracted into the Western Gulf of Maine is, you know, is not supported by the scientific information we have at the moment. We've been conducting a 16-year science experiment here to repopulate the eastern Gulf of Maine with fish from the west. Two things have come out of that are abundantly clear. One is larvae don't swim upstream, and the second is that fish from the western Gulf of Maine don't swim to the east. And it is my contention that until we, you know, solve this underlying issue, this stock assessment is going to be inherently inaccurate. It may be extremely precise. I won't debate that, but it is also inaccurate. And as such, we can't use it for management advice. I'm very sorry. So with that said, I'm going to ask one more question because this is basically, I think, where this whole thing comes down to. In the end, you know, the elephant in the room remains. Why should it be accepted that the current data and model provides the best available science? In 2008, the terminal spawning stock biomass for 2007 was estimated to be 34,000 metric tons, based on the best available science. In 2011, due solely to a recalculation of input data used in the 2008 assessment, the 2007 spawning stock biomass was estimated to be some 14,500 metric tons lower. That's a decrease of about 42%. So to me, it's disturbing to hear that this is the best available science and that we've had, you know, we basically had a 42% error. And so my question is right now, why should we believe you now? That's what this all comes down to. That's what everybody in this room, that's the question they want to ask, and I haven't heard it asked yet. Why should we believe you right now? Suppose you come back in 3 years and go, oh, sorry, you know, something happened. Well, we were actually off by 80% in 2011. The stock is 40% bigger than we thought it was then. So why should we believe you now?
Well, I guess I would reiterate an earlier statement that I made about the degree to which the data were examined during this assessment, that it was, you know, an order of magnitude greater investment, both in terms of the lead analyst and also the process that led up to that assessment. This was previously one of 19 stocks being assessed simultaneously as 19 separate benchmarks. Simply on the basis of the division of labor, it was not possible to make the same type of investment in terms of improving the quality of that assessment. The modeling approach that's used in this assessment it represents a quantum leap in terms of the ability to handle not only the underlying data but also its uncertainty. There was a far more rigorous treatment of the discard information and its consequence, and also the treatment of the landings and survey data as well. I realize I'm in the agency and everyone else is in a difficult situation in this thing, and I fully appreciate the gravity of the question and the context in which we're working now. As you know, science is always one of continuous improvement, and I hope that this is it represents an improvement in that science. It's not one that is solely my hope. I think there was the affirmation that occurred through the peer review process was one that strongly endorsed the approach that was used. Is there a possibility that something is catastrophically wrong in the underlying data? Could it occur again? Could something else be revealed? That's always a possibility. I don't deny that. The changes associated with the recreational catch is again a reflection of a desire, an investment to improve the underlying data for not only this assessment but all stock assessments. There's a major re-examination of the methodology used to estimate that pattern of removals. I think with the development of sectors, there's also a greater degree of accounting of the removals. There's also a greater degree of frequency of observer coverage to try to validate, to a greater extent what is going on in the fishery. So, I guess I would just assert that this is the best that we could do in this context. There are a huge number of uncertainties that have been raised. We're attempting to address them as they arise. But I think the one major structural issue, which is one you've mentioned, is the issue of stock structure and its potential redefinition. But it is one that is would take a concerted effort to redefine the stock and redefine the and fully understand its implications for biological reference points, and also it has definite implications for management.
Well, thank you for that honest answer, because I think that's exactly where we need to go. Before we put everybody in the Gulf of Maine out of business, I think we need to have a thorough reexamination of everything here. We need to examine cod, period. We need new reference points. We need new stock boundaries. We need all this done, and then we can address the underlying problems that, if they still exist. I'm not prepared to shut down the Gulf of Maine or to put out a number there that's, essentially going to shut down the Gulf of Maine until we address these issues. There's no reason to. You've just heard from the man who is in charge of this program that you have serious issues here with stock structure. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the audience. I will ask that any questions be focused on the SOSARC issue that we are discussing. I would also ask people to ask if you have a question that has not already been asked. And there will be additional time today for public comment on what the process that the council is going to work on. So I would like to have any of these questions focused on questions concerning the assessment. Is there anybody who has something? Vito?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Basically, just a comment and process of the SOSARC and working group process. The Northeast Seafood Coalition, the Gloucester Fishing Community Preservation Fund, and Associated Fisheries of Maine, as you know, participated in a partnership to retain Doug Butterworth to attend the working group meeting. And there's I attended the last day, the day that they were basically compiling consensus or wherever they were going to go. And there was definitely a list of open items that everyone agreed needed further investigation and more analyses. And so there's a perception, I think, out there that there was a consensus of the working group that everyone blessed exactly what was there. The reality was that given what they had at the time and what was known up to that point, and absent further review of the list of items, that this was as good as you're going to get up to that point. But certainly it was our understanding going away from that meeting that there was a list of additional work that needed to be done and hopefully have that ready for the SARC. Based upon that very definitive list that we had notes of, we ordered Dr. Butterworth, or I requested that he would do that additional work, and he did. And that work was then disseminated to all of the group, and it went to NIMS. We got copied on it at the exact same time. That work's never really been further considered. The SOC did not really have that put before them on equal footing with the rest of the work. But we continue to talk about the industry participated, and the industry participated, and the industry goes along, and the industry expert agrees. So we don't remember seeing when we look through as lay folks, and Dr. Butterworth I think concurs, we don't really see an explicit list there as it was mentioned. So in the final report, we don't see that list of open items. So I think that may be a problem in the process going forward. It would be good to know, you know, right there coming out of the working group, what that is. Because what is produced from that additional work, even though we talk about the limitations of the data, as Dr. Butterworth shows, a longer time series has a substantial difference in the outcome. And, in fact, it shows a status determination that the stock's not overfished and that there is a range of TACs that could have been considered by the SOC that would have allowed the industry to continue. So I think that's important, and I guess the question is as far as timing. A lot of this additional information was produced prior to the meetings. I'd like to point out that we continually get new information. There's new information today that is already changing results of what you're going to be looking at. So I think there's a little bit of a double standard applied there to what's too late. I mean, guy went out, did extra work, was submitted on time for the SOC or what – but we continue to have new information. The PDT is doing new information. I attended the Groundfish Committee meeting. We did not have the same information that the SSC had. I mean, all credit to them. They're doing tremendous work. They're doing it continuously, and they're submitting it as it gets done. But we have industry work that's being submitted, and it's discounted as not on time and doesn't get put at equal footing. So I just want to make that as a commentary for us. We want to continue to be able to participate in the working group and processes, but it would be good to have a real clear understanding of what is on time and what isn't, what's going to be considered equally, what isn't, and what is truly consensus and what isn't. Thank you. We could have a more clear understanding of, you know, when we go away, of what are the time constraints on new information coming in, because as I say, we're continuously working with new information coming in now, but that's not the same standard held to the private independent science, you know, the industry scientists that come in, that information is not being used. So we're trying to figure out if there's somewhere in a guideline, a protocol of how that works, so we don't hire them next time to do additional work based upon a working group list of recommendations that we never saw.
Thank you, Paul. Did you have a comment on that? Or
I think Jim? I'll let Jim handle the process issue, and I can talk about the technical concerns.
I'm fully aware of the participation with Dr. Butterworth, and I just wanted to point out that with the hiring of the CIE reviewers, there's a contract that we do for each of these review meetings, and in there there's a calendar which specifies when, what they will review and when they're going to get it, and it indicates that we try to provide everything to them that's been written by the working group, and it specifies what reports in fact the working group will produce and give to them approximately 2 weeks before the peer review. And in this case, Dr. Butterworth sent me his own authored paper with Rebecca Rademeyer 2 days before the peer review. And so I didn't quite know what to do with that because I recognized that it was relevant. But when I met with the peer reviewers just before the meeting started, I told them about this paper, and they said, well, let's see how the meeting goes. If we have time to look at it, we will. But we have a lot on our plate, and our contract says that we're to review what we have. So when the meeting played out, they had so much to review in the working papers that by the fourth day, in fact, they were a half a day behind. And it became clear that they couldn't start reviewing a paper which was very analytical that they really hadn't even seen in any detail yet. So we were aware of it. We didn't hide it. And then we started talking about ways that it could be reviewed in the future and thought about the SSC as a venue for doing that. And that's why at the SSC meeting last week, that was one of the topics that was discussed, and that a revision of that paper, which actually had new results, was provided to the SSC. So it has been floating along, and we recognize that it's very relevant to this subject. But in terms of, I just wanted to make it clear how it fit into the SARC process.
I just want to point out, the industry appreciates the opportunity to participate. We also appreciate the timing issues if you've got a CIE contract that gives them 2 weeks. It just would be good if all of that was reflected in the narratives. I mean, when you look at the summaries of the SARC, SARC process, it really doesn't highlight the fact that, okay, we had a contractual technicality that didn't allow us to give adequate consideration of some additional information that was requested by the working group. And I think if there is human limitations to that, given the gravity of the impacts of this assessment, you know, those types of technicalities, if they were pointed out and highlighted, I think would help us move forward even after this interim action, that we look at that on equal footing when we do have time to revisit the stuff and not allow it to fall by the wayside. All right.
Vito, I mean, you were there. It was a term of reference in the SSC committee meeting, and it was discussed there. We may get some more on that during, you know, in the upcoming report on that.
I saw that, but in fact, it's without having the CIE type of review on it. There's no way that the SSC, they're not going to redo the calculations and analyses. They were very limited as how they could consider Dr. Butterworth's, and understandably so. I don't think anyone's done anything incorrect. It's just that the recommendations that came out of the working group, the additional analysis that was done later, that additional analysis was never, because of the contracts and because of the terms of reference of the SSC and the limitations they have, that additional work was never put up at equal evaluation. It just couldn't be. And now that if we have time after these proceedings today, it would be good to put that back on the table and not allow, I don't think the working group, I should say the final reports out of the SSC adequately reflect what that work was and how it could have been evaluated by the SARC, because the SARC didn't evaluate it.
Thank you. I saw one other hand back there. Don? After this, we are going to take a break.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Don Swanson, Coastal Conservation Association, New Hampshire. I'm concerned about the recreational mortality discards, why there was only three things, 0%, 50%, and 100%. We know there is mortality in discards, so that eliminates 0%. We know we don't take every single fish, and fish do go back, so that eliminates the 100%. So that only leaves the 50%. Why wasn't there more looking at maybe at a 25% or 30% or something on that idea there? As using 100% for recreational discards is definitely wrong, because we definitely don't take all the fish, and fish do survive. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a break at this point, come back, and excuse me?
Can I get one question?
You can after the break. So we'll take a 10-minute break and come back, please. Pull back to the table. I'm going to take two more questions on the stock assessment, and then we are going to move on to the SSC presentation. I would also like to make an announcement that Susan Terzakis is here from Senator Ayotte's office. Susan, if people wanted to chat with her, she's going to be here. I saw one hand back here. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. Bill Wagner from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, charter boat operator for the last 35 years. My question deals to predation. I believe Paul said it was 0.2.
Yes.
My question is this. I'm going to just give you a little bit of background to it. It won't take a second. Several years back, the commercial sector had no limit on the amount of spiny dogfish they could land. It was a wide-open fishery. Then data collection and science determined that the spiny dogfish were endangered and being overfished. The fleet has been downsized to around 30 to 40% of what it was. Along came limits to the spiny dogfish of 1,000 pounds per day per boat. This went on about 2 years. This past season, it was 3,000 pounds per boat, both years with TACs attached to them. These dogfish are all the way in New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, here in New Hampshire, up in Maine, and Nova Scotia, all at the same time. This past year, the charter fleet caught more dogfish than they have ever seen. From the beginning of the season to the end of the season, there were dogfish. That equals one very large school of fish. Are there any models that account for the ravenous appetite of the spiny dogfish? Can anyone here predict the amount of cod, haddock, or haddock these fish can consume in a year or 10 years? Do they eat just small fry, or the adults, or both of them? How large a stock will they become? Is this the same science that says the dogfish are endangered? Is this the same science that does not realize that the spiny dogfish may overtake the grounds and become the dominant species in the Gulf of Maine. So I ask, what is the predation levels for the dogfish, Paul?
Thank you, Bill. Dogfish is of course of interest, and the magnitude of consumption is has been great debated in many different circles and arenas. The primary reference on the magnitude of discard, or excuse me, of predation by dogfish on cod is a paper by Jason Link and Frank Almeida. And in that paper, they report the findings of 40,000 dogfish stomachs that were examined. In that estimate, that sample, this was taken in 1999 at a period when the dogfish was very abundant. They found a total of 9 fish. All of those fish were relatively small, on the order of 15 grams. The estimate of consumption based on that was 2.1 million fish. It ranged from about 0.4 to 4 million fish in their estimates of removals. The estimates of recruitment based on the contemporary model and the estimate of Georges Bank recruitment for that same period is on the order of about 10.6 million fish. So, and their estimates were not broken down by stock. So it does represent a large component of the removals of cod. However, the numbers are based on very small. The estimates of removals are based on only 9 fish taken out of 40,000 fish. If you further read their paper, it suggests that the dogfish at that time was not a major component of the structuring of recruitment of gadded fish. Its consumption was much greater for pelagic fish, including herring and various squid species, as well as crustaceans and tenophores.
Okay.
Hi, Paul. Just a quick question on that study of the predation. Where were those dogfish? Where was the scope of the study? Were those dogfish harvested here in the Northeast, or were they more mid-Atlantic? The range of the study, I guess, is my question.
Yeah. Like everyone has said, we get them everywhere. And that was, both in our spring and fall surveys. So it was a summation across the entire range of the resource. So, thank you.
One more audience question, then we're going to move on to the SSC presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim Tower. I have a paddy boat out of Ogunquit. This wasn't what I was going to say, but I was to go along with Bill's thing. If there are a lot of dogfish out there, and there aren't any herring out there anymore, at least not where I fish offshore to caches, what are the dogfish eating? You know, that's one big question. But really, I want to ask specifically, where the largest spike in the most recent recreational catch occurs.
The largest difference that occurs between the MRIP versus the MRFIS, which I assume that's the nature of your question, that occurred in wave two, that is March and April in 2010. That is the primary sort of focal point. Now the difference, and Gordon Colvin will perhaps it'll be talking about that aspect more. But there was a different treatment of the intercept values that occurred as a result of that analysis. The reanalysis of the data. So it downweighted that estimate for 2010 substantially by changing the estimates of that that wave and for the Gulf of Maine and Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
The reason I ask that is that, you know, those 2 months are probably the two least fished months of recreational anglers in anywhere I fish. I rarely see people out there during that time. So the fact that that shows such a high spike seems very inconsistent and, worries me.
Yeah.
Since.
And I think that that worry is reflected in the revision of the estimates and, you know, revisiting of those estimates are, in fact, considerably lower than they were in the Murphis estimates.
And just one more quick one. Are we really going to consider that recreational discards are 100% mortality?
At the risk of sounding silly and but simply reiterating
silly question.
Reiterating what was used in the assessment for the purpose of that evaluation. Was the value that was used. It was the judgment and the summary of the people who were involved in the stock assessment meeting at that time. It is supported by an absence of data to the contrary that suggested that it was significantly higher across the board. There's no question that fishermen can gently handle and release things alive. I don't know how often this occurs for dogfish, but I do think that it can certainly be a consideration for cod.
Well, I can tell you from a personal standpoint, it's a fight to keep the dogfish going back alive. I don't mean to keep harping on this. It seems like every time I come up here, I talk about my own tagging study. But even the tagging studies that have been done, there's a large percentage of returns. I've had 26% on two different occasions. A small number of fish, 1,000 fish or so, but still, they occurred in the years when our the legal size fish was 17 inches. So a lot of these fish were very small. And we had, great return rates. And I was even able to tag one school of fish with 114 individuals. And as the months went on, they were caught along the coast, up to Sagadahoc, up into Nova Scotia. And then 2 years later, a couple times on Cash's Ledge, and then one Scottish seine set south of Cape Cod. And that was at a time when there were a hell of a lot more cod than there are now. So I think the more recent tagging studies don't accurately reflect what's going on with the fishery or what could potentially go on with the fishery if it were as healthy as it was back in those days. So I think you're going to get a skewed view of whatever you see in any of these things.
I would just want to comment that, the center is looking at some of the early historical data on cod tagging, particularly the work done by Bigelow. Which has some remarkable distributional patterns in terms of cod recaptures, which I think will have some broad interest when we finally get all of that historical data processed.
There's one last thing. My contention is if the stock was healthier than it was right now, you'd see there's a hell of a lot bigger disbursement rate than there shows in the tagging studies most recent.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim and Paul, for that report and answering all of those questions. Chris, we're ready to switch over to the SSC report.